Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. I'm back in my home turf. Yahoo! Being on the road for nine days is really just an intense thing, but I'm really glad to be back in my home studio. Also, we have a dynamic guest today. So many times we watch programs on television like NCIS, and we watch others, the 124. There's just so many different programs that are really fascinating to people because they talk about individuals in government doing jobs. Well, the book we're going to be talking about today is The Gray Warriors. Howard Thomas Snow, along with his wife Carol Lavelle, put this book together because he wanted to tell his story, but it is in a novel format. I want to welcome Howard to the show. Hello, Howard.
Hello there.
I'll tell you, I was totally gripped mentally and also visually, I have to say, by your story and the way that it was told. Now, you maintained aircraft for the DEA in Peru.
And the
You've worked
of
above
State.
The Arctic Circle. You've been in Europe, in
mm-hmm.
China.
That's
You've worked
correct.
With King of Saudi Arabia. You've also been involved with the United Nations.
Yes.
And your wife is a woman that has written before, but she's also a playwright and an award-winning poet. I
That's
bet you
great.
You have a romantic story to share.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to do is talk about why you were compelled to write this story. I've known people that have been involved with the intelligence services, and they will never, ever open their mouths or put pen to paper. In fact, one gentleman passed away last year, and he had told me a few of his stories, but he said he would not violate the oath that he took so many, many years ago, and this is a man in his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The intelligence arena is a phenomenal one. The drug enforcement agency is one that has just unbelievable assignments that are given to them. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, one reason was because a friend of mine who tried to write another book about this program, but he did not follow the 7-year period of secrets. And he wrote a very nice book, but the Department of State confiscated his book, put him in federal prison for a short period of time, and his book never came out, except in a very funny place. And that was Hustler magazine. They had the first couple of chapters, which they published in their book. And he was one of my best friends. And he says, I hope that someday that somebody else will try to write more about what we did at that particular time and place. And the people that I've worked with, my wife has found them very exciting. And this is why she started writing. And, of course, she's written other books. And we tried to keep it as like fiction, but in reality it's based on actual facts that took place with the people that I worked with over a 4.5-year period. And that's one of the reasons. And also, what is a drug war? That's something that we've been trying to abolish, and it becomes bigger and bigger every year, and almost nobody ever talks about it.
And I agree with you.
And that's one of the reasons that we did, in fact, write about it, because the people of Peru are such nice people. It's a beautiful country that had years and years of war. And it was by many different people. For example, the North Koreans supported the problems that we had. At one time, they were fighting the Russians there in Peru. And then the Sendero Luminoso, sometimes called the Shining Path, they were nothing but a bunch of drug dealers that
mm-hmm.
were ravaging the country. And I wanted to see that particular part of the world to, you know, become a logical nice functioning country as it used to be. I mean, they had beauty there that I just cannot describe. But the problems that we're having now, like with the drug wars in Mexico and in the United States, also brought it back up to, you know, that I could legally write about it. And that was one of the reasons that we did it. Not necessarily for financial gain. We'd like to sell a lot of books, but it's something that needs to be included within the history of our country.
I agree. And I think there's been too much secrecy, too much of what I call the milquetoast attitude regarding this. And the lives of many people, Americans and otherwise, have been not just destroyed, but often those that have been involved in the work have been so discouraged because they feel as if many times the understanding of people works against them. And there is so much that's going on. And when you're fighting particular groups and organizations, and they have gazillions of dollars, and maybe all you've got is a few toothpicks to work with, it can make it a pretty tough situation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's sort of paint the scene here. We're going into 1990.
All right.
And this is the Santa Lucia base in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And you start off right at the very beginning of your book saying it starts as an ordinary Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
The Peruvians rebel, the communists, or Sendero Luminoso, as they call themselves, and the drug traffickers. They would attack the base sometimes on weekends.
When the moon was full.
When the moon was full, but it wasn't going to be full for another week. It wasn't raining, so you figured there was going to be an attack. And
well,
this really happened.
What happened in that particular one? A group of people, basically narco traffickers out of Colombia, were supplying a great deal of people from other parts of the country, like Israel, Great Britain, the Special Forces, to retrain the people to become soldiers, very good soldiers. And for a period of time of several weeks, we were discovering they were attacking police stations as military people would do, not as a rebel group of people that would come in blowing their horns and whistles and making a lot of noise and shoot off a few rounds of ammunition and go home. They were well-trained troops.
Mm-hmm.
And we had certain things there, like helicopters, that they really wanted to capture and use for the drug travel that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, on that particular night, I was one of the inspectors. In other words, after we inspect the aircraft each day, you have to write up reports. And I went down to a little bodega, that just means a little shack, that I was working on down there and doing my daily paperwork to send back to the capital city. And all of a sudden, we started hearing noises, you know, very faint noises, and they came from a different direction than we had ever come from. And they were coming down the runway that we had built there to bring cargo and so forth into that part of the country. And when I woke up to the fact I was surrounded by the people, all I could do was to try to hide until I could do something more effectively, because I only had one weapon with me, and that was a 9mm with two clips of ammunition. As near as we could figure out, they had about 600 people attacking our base, and we had a number of people there of about 90 to defend ourselves. And all of a sudden, one of the guard towers around it realized that somebody was there, and they turned on their spotlight, and that's when the battle begun. And 90 people against 600 that are trained by people, let's say, from Israel, that was a lieutenant colonel, or from the British group, which were their special forces. We had quite a fight, and all we could do to survive, if at all possible, was to get the helicopters up where we had our machine guns to defend the base. They wanted to capture the helicopters. And about all I could do was start remembering things that I'd been taught by my grandfather after my dad died, and I went to live with him in Texas. And he says, you never give up. You never stop trying. And you react. And also, at that point, I got such a shot of adrenaline in my system, everything seemed to slow down so I could see everything that was going on. And they were already past me. They were in some revetments we used to drain water away from our camps. And we were basically in for a major fight. And all I could do was to come up with some basic ideas, I guess like MacGyver, in which I found some methylketone, which is a chemical that we use to clean aircraft with, but it's also very flammable. And I made a couple of bombs out of it, which I threw on some people. I had one pistol. I had two clips with me. And basically, I started firing from behind. And by that time, all of my people started defending the camp. In other words, we lived in tents with sandbags around it. And so many of the people that were fighting there, we discovered something. We were supposed to call in to Lima, Peru, to the embassy and tell them that we needed help. Except instead of having our Marine guards there listening to the radio, nobody was there. We would call for help, and we'd call for help, and, you know, we had to wait for, you know, communications. We finally had to call Colorado, a place out there that had major communications, and they called Peru and woke up somebody and said, hey, your base is under attack.
Amazing.
It really was amazing. And the strange thing about it is, when you look into the official records, they said there was a firefight at San Lucita, base that lasted for 2 hours. There were no casualties on either side. Now, that's the official version that shows up on the Internet. And in reality, there was a lot of people that were hurt and so forth. We defended ourselves the best that we could, and because we could get the helicopters up in the middle of a firefight, we could start a circling combat assault on the area. And we got 5 helicopters up, loaded with DEA people and any ammunition that they had for their weapons, and we started making a bigger and bigger circle, and they started retreating finally. And that's how we basically survived. And in the book, they talk about different people. The one thing that I noticed was two of my friends, when I was trying to get back to my camp, I ran out of energy, in other words, as the adrenaline burned off, and I just kind of like a limp rag, and I basically said, I need help. And these two guys grabbed some shotguns and pistols, and they came out and got me out of the combat area and back into a vetment where we could survive. And those are two of my very best friends in the whole world to this very day. One of them is Spanish background, and the other one's out of North Carolina. These type of people are only found in certain parts of the world where they're willing to give up their life, if need be, to protect the life of somebody else while they're doing their duties. Most of these people came out of the Vietnam period. That's another reason I called the Gray Warriors, because many of us had gray hair. And our helicopters are painted gray, and our airplanes are painted gray.
Interesting.
And that's one of the reasons I picked the name the Gray Warriors. And also, we were to keep a very low profile. We could be defensive, but we could not be offensive, except in a couple of cases in which we rescued people. And that particular battle raged on for over 2 hours before they retreated. And the next day, we buried the dead. And there was a lot of them, and on our side and on their side, even though the official version is there are nobody that was hurt during that two-hour firefight, which I find kind of ridiculous. But that's the official version that the U.S. government has on the Internet. But
well, I think that it's so important that people like yourself are coming out and telling the truth, because there has been, and I think we are in a cycle right now, where it's important for the truth to be known. There has been so much fabrication, so many lies, so much cover-up. It sounds like a Hollywood movie. But
it is.
It really is surreal when you hear the true stories from people who have actually walked the walk. When I was in Washington, D.C., on Sunday, Mm-hmm. I was on a shuttle, and a very attractive young lady was sitting next to me. And she had just gotten back from Iraq. She's mm-hmm. with the Navy, and she is a medic.
Mm-hmm.
And she was there, and she was talking about how when she was in, she said, we were put through training, we went through all kinds of psychological evaluations,
mm-hmm.
but there is no way, she told me, that you can prepare for what you are going to experience there. She said, there is absolutely no way you can describe it. She said, I cannot tell you how grateful I was to be in a place, to come home, and to have running water.
Oh, yes.
So you're talking in your book,
mm-hmm.
well, my listeners, they need to know, you're talking about the Amazon jungle. You are talking about being in an environment, high humidity, lots and lots and lots and lots of bugs.
And
this isn't something where you're going to go around and try to look like a commercial on television. It doesn't work that way. You're lucky if you stay that way for 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very, very primitive environment, yet the people that you found coming up against you
mm-hmm.
and the story evolving about the British, military specialist and
mm-hmm.
the Israeli specialist that you found out about.
A sergeant major.
Yes, and there he is. He's there because, and the Israelis had a fit when they found out
mm-hmm.
because what he was doing, but he was doing it illegally because he wanted to make money.
Sure, lots of money from the narco traffickers. They had millions.
So here you have this situation. You also have something when you have villagers
mm-hmm.
who have known nothing but poverty, and then they're paid off. It reminds me so much of what the mafia is like, you know, in the United States. It's the same kind of thing, but it's dealing in drugs. And this is worldwide.
Yes,
this
it is.
This is something that's not just, excuse me, in South America, just because there's a bunch of stupid people down there. I beg to differ with individuals. It is not a bunch of stupid people. These are very intelligent people. They have the finest weapons that you can possibly get in the world. The black market is supplying them. And they don't know rules. There are no rules. Am I wrong?
That's true. But what is the two major exports of America? Food and weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And has been since, you know, World War II. And actually slightly before that period of time. And that's always been a fact of life. We produce food that we send around the world, and we send weapons around the world. And that really came to my eyesight when I was over in Africa with the United Nations, and there was a recoilless rifle there that's had the 45th Division stamp still on it, and how it got from Southeast Asia, where it was supposed to be sent, to Africa, you know, people deal in weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the United Nations group bringing a country out of 26 years of, you know, tribal warfare between the two people. And with the United Nations, our only, how can I put it, protection was our blue hats. We carried no weapons, and but we did have access to them if we really needed them, from the mm-hmm. Russians and from the French, you know, to protect our camps if we really needed them. But there in Peru, we were basically on our own. I have in my, what I call, Steptoe's file, a letter that was sent to us when they were talking about an E&E, emergency evacuation of that area. And they concluded that there was no emergency evacuation there in the Rio Huallaga Valley, so we should defend our camp as if it was the Alamo. And I thought that was a very non-appropriate statement. And you know what happened at the Alamo? Nobody
yes,
survived.
Yes, everybody died. Right.
So,
don't you just love it?
I always keep these funny things that have come up over the years as I have worked around the world with different groups, primarily the U.S. government, as well as the international government, such as the United Nations, as the absurdity of how people look at things. We could be defensive, but we could not be offensive. If you defended yourself, that was all right. But if you went out to try to stop people before they got to your camp, that was against the rules.
And they don't have any rules.
And they have no rules. But we had to live by certain rules, like after the Battle of San Lucia, all the helicopter pilots that were there and that were became aggressive on the second night to prevent them from attacking our camp again were fired and sent out of country. And we had to get all new pilots. That's where I ended up flying quite often with them. because I am a pilot. But if you were offensive, the Department of State said, bad, and then send them out of the country.
Do you think sometimes they've watched too many John Wayne movies?
Yeah, or Rambo movies, where one person can knock down 100 people.
Right.
In reality, you can't do it.
No, it doesn't work that way. That, I really find it very interesting. Now, I know, you know, we as a nation, we've been involved in all kinds of things, and there's no such thing as lily white hands on any part of this planet. But there is a phenomena that occurs so many times with people who are making decisions, and they have never once served a day in any kind of a conflict, in any kind of an event where they have really had to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that I find quite fascinating.
Well, it could be from my own background, because one of my earliest ancestors, and he came from New York, defended at the Alamo, and his brother was at Goliad. And I guess that's carried through my family, because everybody from World War I to World War II to the Korean conflict in my family have gone to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my period of time when Southeast Asia occurred, which we call the Vietnam War. And once you are involved in that type of work, it's very difficult to find other types of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I originally got involved in it because I needed to make money to pay for my older son's medical expenses. And I found out how good my insurance wasn't. And that was one of the reasons that I went to Peru working for an oil company. When our camp was overrun and all the people were killed, I was shot and stabbed and left for dead. And I had to take myself out of the jungle by myself. When the helicopters flew over, all they saw was dead people and burned out facilities that we had there. And for several days, I walked out of the jungle after sewing myself up, because I had been trained as a combat medic, and I knew what to do. But I also remember my grandfather saying, never give up.
Mm-hmm.
Always. Because he was quite a remarkable man. He lived to be 96 years of age and worked the last day of his life, and he came in from the farm field and had a heart attack and died. And I hope I have become the same kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe for another 10 years more.
You know, Howard, when your story, there is all of this truth that just has a little bit of airbrushing of
yes,
fiction.
It does.
And I really appreciate it, all the information that's in there. For those of you listening, The Gray Warriors is not something that should be read by anybody that wants to believe in La La Land. This mm-hmm. is real. This is something I know. I've talked to too many veterans. I've spoken to men and women both from the Vietnam War, from the World War I, believe it or not, also World War II, and I'm not that old. But it's something, when you sit and you talk with people like Howard and others, you're going to find that they have experienced something that they're really going to be very cautious about talking with you about, because you're going to try to put it into some kind of a television show that somebody has put together with a romantic ending. And lots of times the endings are far from romantic. Howard, you talked about how you were approached by someone from the State Department long before you ever made certain choices.
Well,
they approached you to become a part of the DEA.
All right. Well, it was Department of State, and we were working with the DEA at that time. Later
okay.
on, I became a special agent for the DEA in Hawaii. But this was because of my contacts in Southeast Asia at an earlier period of time. I went to work for a company that was run by the Department of State, and I was basically a bean counter, but we were in Thailand, and then we went to Cambodia and Laos and up in the Montagnard areas during that period of time. And the people I met at that period of time became my contacts later in life. And then when I went there with the oil company and got hurt, they medevaced me back to Florida. And about 15 minutes away, at a place called Opa-locka, the same hangar that the Cuban, how do I want to put it, when we attacked Cuba with a group of former Cubans, this was the same hangar that they were trained in. And that's where the Department of State had a training thing about 15 minutes away from my hospital. And when you come in, they swipe your passport, and bingo, you know, it comes up on the computer, hey, one of our older people are back in country. And so the man came to the hospital room that I was in, and he basically offered me a job when I got well. And so I went back to Florida, and that's how I ended up down in Peru again. So one was with an oil company, and the other was Department of State. And I was part of the embassy at that particular period of time when I went back, because I went from a blue passport to a black passport. And that's how they got in contact with me again, because we were just a few minutes apart there in Florida. And as I recuperated, I went back down there and started working on their airplanes for them here in the United States, and then I was sent overseas again to Peru, which was supposedly supposed to be one of the best places to go to, even though we had people in Bolivia, Colombia, and some other places at that time. And that's where I basically worked out of for the next several years. And because I was able to test the helicopters or test flight them, because I had a helicopter rating as well as a pilot's rating, I just kind of worked my way into the business, you know, more and more, and they kept giving me more responsibility. And that's exactly how I got contacted by the Department of State a second time in my life. In other words, they keep track of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you follow all the rules, including like the 7-year rule, hey, I still have good contacts with the people. In other words, because I have not violated any of their rules.
Mm-hmm.
I've used their rules, but I haven't violated their rules.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most important part of it.
Howard, I know we're getting close to being out of time. And for those of you listening, the book is The Gray Warriors. It is written as a novel, but a good 98.7% of it is real, and the rest of it is airbrushing, as I like to say. You can go to The Gray Warriors or just graywarriors.com, and you can look up the website, as I know so many of you are. I want to ask you a question, Howard.
Yes.
The war on drugs. I have no clue about the amount of money right at this moment, but it's in the billions of dollars that has been spent.
Yes, it is.
Is it worth waging the war on drugs? I mean, we've got people that would they've taken over areas of country to
mm-hmm.
be able to rule as kings or queens.
But who are the number one demanders of that drugs? They are the United States and Europe.
United States and Europe. So if we wanted to get rid of this, it's okay, folks, give up the stuff.
Well, take a look what's going on in California, Washington, and Oregon. They're talking about legalizing marijuana. What's the biggest dollar producer in the U.S. right now? Methamphetamines, which they can cook up in any home
yes.
address that they have out of whatever kind of poisons they happen to have around the house.
Mm-hmm.
And people will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
When we moved into the where I'm living now in Tulsa, when I got married to my wife, we had some people across the street and down the street. They were drug dealers. I helped to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's quite apparent. They didn't work, and they had two new Mercedes and unlimited money to spend.
Mm-hmm.
And every day or every Friday, you would see a UPS or a FedEx send their drugs in because they haven't violated any federal laws, you know, like coming through the U.S. mail. Oh, we have all these loopholes. Only one country in the world has really tried to limit the amount of drugs and all the problems that come along with it, like HIV and so forth, and that's the Netherlands. All the rest of the world, I don't know what we're trying to do with that. In other words, many of the drugs that we have, you know, God gave us. In other words,
mm-hmm.
like some of the opiates that they made, like Paregoric out for children, you know, for teething and upset stomachs when they were born for 150 years.
Right.
Now that's now against the law. But you can't, the only way you can get rid of the drugs is to make it, and I even hate to say it because the Netherlands did it, they legalized it, but they also made very strong penalties if you violated any of the rules. You can go to Needle Park there in Amsterdam, they'll give you the drugs if you apply for it. But now if you're out trying to peddle it, you'll end up in prison forever.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you take the the money factor out of it, there won't be any drug, going around. It's like California. You can have 5 plants in your house for things like glaucoma and cancer. But look at the greenhouse they have there. That's the number 2 money maker in California. It's drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Missouri has the same thing going. I've been involved with that one, too. But Hawaii, my goodness, it's a game out there. For example, if you have 99 plants, it's a misdemeanor. If you have 100 plants, it's a federal offense and go to federal prison. So guess where they put all their plants? In the federal forest. And it has the highest THC factor in the world.
Anyway,
it's strange. And the other thing that, like in Peru, the government offered them money to stop, picking the coca leaves. And they could make $1 a day. But if they picked the leaves, the narco traffickers paid them $3 a day. Now, if I'm getting $1 to live on or $3, and my wife can make $3, and my children can make $3, pretty soon I'm going to have a tin roof on my hut, and pretty soon I'll have a TV antenna on top.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then I'll have a moped. But if I go the other way, I'm going to starve to death. In other words, you need to take the incentive out of it.
Correct.
And that would be the only way to really eliminate it, and the HIV problems that we have, and the needle problems, and the methamphetamine problems, if there is no profit in it.
Very good point. In fact, just as a closing comment, drug use in this country had been on the rise quite a bit before the Second World War, and then there was no money availability,
mm-hmm.
so people couldn't buy, and it literally went almost totally away. And the problems that accompanied it went almost totally away. But
mm-hmm.
as soon as the finances started coming back, then it started coming back in big time.
And
amazing
who?
Stuff, amazing story. Your book, Gray Warriors, is great. Go to Howard Thomas Snow's website, which is graywarriors.com. Howard, it's been a delight having
it's
you.
It's been a
guest.
Delight, and I definitely enjoyed the conversation with you.
Thank you so much. I know my listeners did, too.
All
Maybe
right.
they heard something that they didn't expect to hear.
Well,
because
tell them to buy
a
book.
This,
and also,
buy the book. It's the real thing. It's not
It's a real
police.
Thing.
It is the real thing. Thank you again,
Thank
Howard,
you very
for
much.
Being my guest. Howard Thomas Snow, the book, The Gray Warriors, eye-opening and riveting. I can tell you that because I read the whole thing. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go
All
away.
Right. All right. Bye-bye.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are open. If you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, here is the telephone number. We only have one now. It's worldwide. Anybody can call in. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. For those of you who might be listening to the show for the first time, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. Then let me, after you call in, which I'd like to know where you're calling from, too. Let me give you the information or perceptions that I have, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. So it's 888-815-9756. Well, as I said, it's so nice to be back in the home office. Robins are outside just popping all over the place, and our flowers are just in gorgeous, gorgeous bloom. It is so good to be back in the Pacific Northwest. I want to thank the people on the East Coast that I had the opportunity to interact with, whose hospitality and generosity has just made the trip back there so very, very significant. But I wanted to share something with you. All of us are very concerned about this planet that we live on, mainly because we're discovering that we need to do more than we realize to make it better. Back on the East Coast, I've been aware for many, many years that they were having problems in the Chesapeake Bay. Pollution was really, really bad. But these people have worked very earnestly at trying to reverse the diseases because of pollution that were attacking so many of the forms of life that had so generously been supplying our nutritional needs for a lot of generations. Oyster beds had become contaminated. There were all kinds of different fish. Well, one of the fish back on the East Coast is called a shad. Now, they go from the ocean into river spawning grounds. They're just very, very much like the salmon out here on the West Coast. And the conservationists have really been quite anxious because they had done a four-year assessment on this particular fish. And in 2007, they found that this Atlantic Coast native was at its lowest amount ever. They just were not coming back. And the decline continued in 2008. Now, the shad, as a fish, has gone through this kind of a cycle before. What is it caused by? Overfishing. I've mentioned pollution. Also, because a lot of spawning grounds were blocked by dams that had been built. And in the early 1990s, rivers had been cleaned up in many, many areas. They had put in fish ladders, and they found that it was just wonderful. They were coming back. There was a lot of wonderful, wonderful encouragement by what they were seeing. However, they have electrofishing surveys that they do. And what that is, they use an electric current to briefly stun fish so that they can count them. It doesn't hurt them, just causes them to be still long enough so that they can count them. And they found that this fish has not been coming back the way that they thought it had been. And they said the downward trend of this one fish, the shad, really started being noticed around the year 2000. Now, there's Michael Hendricks. He's a fisheries biologist, and he is really involved in what's called the Anadromous Fish Restoration Unit at the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission. Now, he said offshore fishing for herring, mackerel, and other species could be part of the problem, because the young shad, since they go out into the ocean, might be getting picked up along with this as well, so they don't even have a chance of surviving that. So they're really doing a lot of research, and there are those people at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and the Sunny College of Environmental Studies and Forestry. They're really examining these fish carefully. Now, one of the ways that they're trying to find out information is through their ear bones. Now, that is something that I never in a million years would have even considered as being significant into the survival, understanding the survival of a fish. But the bones of the fish's ear provides history, a lot of detail to those people that have the understanding of it, as to where these fish have traveled, and also see if there is something in the local water chemistry that could be affecting them. They say they're trying to identify important spawning grounds to see what they can do to protect this fish and see it be restored. Now, they said the shad populations that were around during colonial times in this country, they don't know that that'll ever be possible because they were just thick as they could be in the waters of the United States. But they say they're hoping this fish, which carries crucial nutrients from the environments that it lives in, from the ocean to the rivers, it's also a food source for other fish, bass, bluefish, and predatory birds. You see, if we can bring it back, it's going to improve a link in the food chain. And I think that's something that we've really had to go through a lot of pain and suffering, and we're still doing it. And understanding that when we have the massive fishing that we have, when you're pulling in tons of fish on a daily basis, tons of it, you're just wiping out populations. And there are some trawlers out there that are so efficient that there are, you know, ocean bottoms that are literally devoid of all life. Now, it doesn't take long for fish populations to come back if they're left alone for a while. And there's a couple of communities. There was one friend of mine who happened to be a native of Michigan, and there was a particular lake, he said, that had just been totally, totally destroyed because of pollution and also fish species. There was overfishing there. And they closed down this water area, which was immense. Sports fishers, fishermen and fisherwomen just loved going out there. But they closed it down. Nobody was allowed to fish there. They restocked the waters, made it so that nobody could go into those waters at all. It was a good water area, good-sized area. And they made so for 3 years. Nobody could fish there. The fish population came back in amazing numbers. And this is something that is needing to be done in so many different areas. There are places in Maryland, for example. We were with some people in an area of Maryland, and for years they were not allowed to do any kind of crabbing. And they could not go out and get any kind of crabs. One, the area was polluted, so they were concerned about toxins that you would ingest. But more than that, because crabs are scavengers, they eat everything. They're like lobster. They just are what you call the vacuum cleaners of whatever areas they occupy. Anything and everything becomes a part of the food store. They help to keep the areas clean and healthy. So what happens is they were almost wiped out there. So they couldn't do anything for a number of years. They couldn't touch them. And now they just, I think it was just this year, I could be wrong. Those of you that might be listening in Maryland, you can feel free to correct me. But they did recently open it up, and there was a crab feast that we were invited to enjoy. And these crab were not all that big, really, when you looked at them. They might be, a little bit, about as big around as a saucer, coffee cup saucer. And they were bringing them in, but it was okay. But you had to be very careful, because if they were too big or they were too small, you weren't allowed to take them. So it's really interesting how we are becoming aware of the infrastructure between different species, number one, because you have to have the plankton, you have to have all of these different areas and sections in the food structure so that the species can maintain their own strength and their numbers. But we are going to find that aquafarms are going to become more and more prevalent. Why? We've got a lot of people to feed on this planet, and there are ways of doing it, and little by little we're becoming aware about how we can do it so that those fish coming from the fish farms are going to be healthy, and they're going to have those nutrients, and it's not going to pollute the ocean waters. It's really going to make a big difference. The Romans did it. The Polynesians did it for centuries because they overfished too. So this isn't something new for the human population. But when we learn, let's hope we remember to take care of them. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. We're going to be back in just a moment. I'll tell you who's coming up this week as guests on my show. And also, we're going to be talking pizza. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. I know we've got a caller on the line. Please wait just a moment because I want to let you know who I'm going to have this week. Tomorrow, it's going to be Bringing Your Soul to Light. Dr. Linda Beckman is going to be with me. And then, for those of you who are single and just say, I've had it with dating, well, we're going to talk with Marla Martinson. She is so much fun. Good date, bad date. We're going to get the lowdown on it. And then for those of you, if any of you have ever had anyone in your family deal with the problems of alcoholism, friends, I don't know of anybody that isn't touched by this situation at one time or another. Roy Escapa is going to be my guest. He will be calling in from Europe. There is a cure for alcoholism. Unbelievable? It's for real. The people in Denmark have been using it for over 20 years, and it works. So we're going to be talking about that this week, a dynamic lineup. I invite you to tell your friends, join me, because we've got super people here on the Donna Sebo Show, and they all have something to bring to the table, to bring to your table, your listening table, so that you can know that you can be empowered in your life by becoming educated, making choices, know that there are options out there. Let's go to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hi, who do I have on the air?
This is Don.
Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Don, the first thing that I'm looking at with you is a very strong sense of loyalty. You have an excellent mind. I believe you feel like you're at a crossroads at this time
of
your life.
You kidding?
When I'm watching you, I want you to be aware that because things don't seem to be moving real quickly for you, if you will just have patience, and I'm not saying this to try to make you feel better, but there are so many various circumstances that need to come into positioning before you're going to be able to feel like you can really move forward with the speed and the dynamics that you want to move forward with. the aspect of patience, and I know sometimes you feel like you don't have a heck of a lot of it, but that's all right. Be patient. Do whatever you need to do to maintain your focus, keep your focus, and then what you're going to find is that dedication, that consistency, all of those disciplines that you have worked so diligently at refining, they are coming into the right positioning so that you, by this fall, will see how everything is falling into place the way that it should. There are no shortcuts, Don, none. So you need to keep in mind, you just keep those little tiny baby steps in motion so that you can reach that destination that you want. You're also going to find yourself back in school. There is a There are a number of classes that you may find yourself having an interest in. That's good. Just remember, the objectives, the primary objective that you have in front of you, stay on target with that. Don't let anything take you off track. You know, having a diversion once in a while, that's okay. But you just need to keep your focus. Keep your focus, keep your discipline right there in that top slot, and you are going to find yourself achieving exactly what you want to achieve. But it is very methodical. Much of the action is going to be monotonous, but it will get you there. But it's just one step at a time. Once in a while, you'll be able to take a couple of extra steps, but usually it's one step at a time. What would you like to ask me, Don?
Oh, you touched on some of the issues already. It's the feeling of things piling up and being paralyzed. It's not just procrastination. It's, I don't know how to explain it. It's feeling like this massive wall in front of you, and you have to break through it somehow.
Let me just reiterate what I said to you. You're going to need to take little tiny baby steps, like one little step at a time. It's sort of like dealing with a room, a 10-by-10 room filled with paper, and you know you must go through every single piece of paper before you can discard it. And you look at the whole room, and you think, it might be better just to put a match to the whole thing. Forget this stuff. But you can't do it.
I can give a footnote to that. That's really funny because, first of all, I'm buried in clutter. I'm a hoarder of sorts. And also, I'm writing a 700-poem cycle where it's all disorganized. There's pages here and pages there. And it is exactly what you said, like feeling buried in it,
love it
and feeling like putting the match to it sometimes or throwing it all out in the trash, you know.
All right, let me give you a suggestion. Let me give you a suggestion because this is something, again, it's like dealing with one sheet at a time. I would encourage you to maybe contact either someone that's associated with a college, or there might be some young people that want to be able to maybe make a little bit of extra money, whatever. You need someone that's got an organizational capability where they could go through this with you and categorize it and help you organize it. And if you could work with them maybe once or twice a week, and then they could tell you, you could say, well, that could be thrown away because I don't need it. Then they'd throw it away and they'd take it out of your side of, you know, your line of vision. But if you could get someone to help you, that would really speed this up. But again, you have to be methodical. You cannot just put a match to everything. That's not the smart thing to do. Don, I regret I'm out of time. I'm going to have to go.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I appreciate your phone call.
Thank
you. You have a wonderful evening in Philadelphia.
Thank you. And you
you're welcome, sir. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, the hour has just flown by. Back in my home turf, and I'm so delighted to be able to share good times with you. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Dr. Linda Beckman. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. And remember, to know how to think, to be able to analyze to dig for information, to be able to reach for your best. Don't be afraid to explore some options and things that you've never considered. Learning and growing comes from looking at life from different perspectives. There's no one way of doing anything. There are many different facets that can be incorporated. And it's when we grow and expand that we realize how very, very, very rich we are in this experience of life. But it's only when we grow that we can find out how great we truly can become. This is Donna Sebo. I'll be talking with you tomorrow, right here, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.